In this week's programme, Paul views life of Charles Stewart Parnell. Professor Bew tells us that he's building on his 1980 book with the help of significant new research on Parnell's family background, intellectual formation and early career inside and outside Parliament. Both biographies argue that for all the speculation about Parnell's flirtation with neo-Fenianism, that he was fundamentally a constitutionalist and that his primary concern was the survival of his own landlord class. Parnell believed that the land question took priority over home rule. If the conflict between landlords and tenants could be brought to an end, then both classes were much more likely to unite in seeking home rule. With me, Frank Callanan, who's a lawyer, biographer and Parnell scholar. He's written A Life of Tim Healy. Charles Lycett is a lawyer and former president of the Cambridge Union. He has written a biography of Brendan Bracken. Margaret O'Callaghan, who teaches politics at Queen's University, is author of British High Politics and a Nationalist Ireland, Criminality, Land and the Law under Forster and Balfour. It's published by Cork University Press. Frank Callanan, what did you think of Paul Bew's book?
Well, it's a really impressive book. It's very gracefully written. I mean, it's more, I suppose you'd say, a biographical essay or a political essay than a full biography. I mean, if you're looking for a full biography, you'd still go back to Lyons. But it is, I think, a magnificent work. What I suppose I thought is most successfully realised is the treatment of the early Parnell, how Parnell deals with the land question. And that is absolutely brilliant because it just picks up a politician at work, because you've a whole load of contemporary theories. Some of them are fads, some of them are to do with particular ideologies. You know, the Fenians, the High Fenians, were very suspicious of contaminating the national question with the land question. The left wing of what became the Parliamentary Party are suspicious. They think, John Dillon, people like that, think, well, if you give the land to the farmers, they'll stop being nationalist. So there are all these considerations. Some people are in favour of peasant proprietorship. Some people are in favour of just land reform. Some people are in favour of land nationalisation. Davitt, in a sort of academic way, is. And Parnell, it's just to watch, and this is what I think is most beautifully realised in the book, watching a politician of Parnell's acumen picking his way through those options and going for what in retrospect seems so obvious, but wasn't obvious at
the time,
and was beautifully plucked by Parnell. That was the strategy.
Margaret O'Callaghan, can we hear you on the book?
I would agree with Frank. I mean, I think it's beautifully written. It's really elegantly constructed. And one of the most powerful aspects of it, I think, is it gives you almost a sense that you're there beside Parnell. I'd agree with Frank, particularly the early Parnell. You're looking over his shoulder. So Bew has gone through an extraordinary amount of material and distilled it into a very elegant narrative line. He's brilliant, I think, on the Parnell family background, on the ways in which they both are Wicklow gentry but aren't typical Wicklow gentry. He does bring out the preceding generations who had, you know, written on behalf of the Catholics of Ireland. So you have a sense of Parnell as both of his class and yet not quite of it. His bohemian mother, the fact that they spend so much time in Paris, the network of relationships with his siblings, his period in the States. I think that's all brought through incredibly strongly. Yeah, I agree with Frank. The period 1875 to 1879 or 80 is brilliantly done, because you see Parnell, you know, beginning as a particular kind of young man who, you know, sets himself up for an electoral future. I suppose I'd slightly disagree with the contention that Parnell himself always had land as a priority over home rule. Mm-hmm. But I would agree with Frank's point that, Bew does show us Parnell, you know, carefully navigating his way through all kinds of complex alternative ways of dealing with land.
Charles Lycett, your view of it?
Yes, well, I agree with two great experts speaking of before me. But I think, in a way, there's some tendency in historians and people writing, that they, to a degree, recreate the subject in their own image. Now, Paul Bew has had a very interesting life. He started with the People's Democracy, mm-hmm. and he ended up really working for David Trimble in the Ulster Unionist. And he has been, one consistent strain through his life is a kind of devotion to Irish pluralism. And I think he is very anxious to recreate Parnell as a pluralist champion of having an Ireland that embraced different traditions. And I think he's that is the image of Parnell which he pushes. Now, it's very difficult to make out Parnell because he was such a reserved figure. But I'm not sure that the early Parnell was such a pluralist, really, before 1882, or such a conservative figure. I think he was possibly rather angry, anti-English, an angry man. He was certainly a very angry man. And I think, in a way, Paul Bew seems to see a consistency, and perhaps he's right. But I would think Gladstone may have been right when he thought that Parnell changed from being an Anglophobe, if you like, about 1881 and 82, and became a much more moderate figure and essentially a conservative figure.
Do you go along with him, Frank, with Paul Bew, that is, when he stresses that it was Gladstone's perception of Parnell as a moderating force that won him over to the Home Rule idea, Gladstone, that is?
Yes, that's certainly a central development. I mean, it's a very fraught relationship, Parnell, Gladstone. I mean, on Parnell's side, it was cold enough. I mean, he never really liked Gladstone, and personally, though he was perfectly happy to do business with him politically, but in the split, Parnell's rage at Gladstone is, I mean, it is unfeigned. I think there's some reference at some point to being dismissed like a servant. I mean, he was incensed at what he saw as Gladstone's hypocrisy, his intervention in Irish affairs, and to an extent unforgiving towards himself for having let Gladstone get into that position. I mean, it is an extraordinary relationship between two master politicians who didn't have that much in common temperamentally.
Margaret, did you see the relationship?
Well, I mean, it's of initial dislike, I think, on Parnell's part, and I'm not sure it ever greatly changes from that. I think you can overemphasise the role of Parnell's personality in persuading Gladstone of the merits of Home Rule. I mean, Gladstone is, you know, he's high political forces operating upon him. Also, he is, you know, perhaps much to Parnell's disgust, constantly reading Irish history. I mean, he's a whole network of influences bearing upon him. So this book is written as the biography of an individual and the narrative of a political movement. But I think it's important not to reduce the whole movement to the relationship between those two individuals. It's not because of Parnell alone that Gladstone moves. I agree with Paul's desire to emphasise the extent to which Parnell wants to keep a landlord class on board. But to suggest somehow that the landlords are his primary interest is, I think, absurd. To present him as an extreme conservative is also ridiculous. If you look at the nature of his speeches, even, you know, between 82, 83 and 86, they're not the speeches of a conservative. He's sufficiently conservative, perhaps, to allow Gladstone to persuade himself that he's not dangerous. But he's not a conservative man speaking exclusively in the landlord interest.
How did the Irish landlords view him, Charles? What's your impression of that?
Oh, I don't think too favourably. I mean, they'd have regarded him as a deserter to their class and I suppose an awkward kind of figure. He was a cricketer as a young man and he was a pretty unsporting cricketer. So that would have been remembered. And
but didn't they
an
feel,
awkward cast they'd have seen
but
him
didn't
as.
They feel they might benefit in benefit financially from the Treasury in the eventual outcome of land reform were it to happen, Frank?
It hadn't really got to that stage in their perceptions of their self-interest.
Bew uses the great term, you know, that I think it's called kind of a ripeness in politics. And it's clearly the case that the landlords are not ready to be bought out on favourable terms, even if it is in their economic interest, until much later in the day than the point at which Parnell thinks it's a brilliant idea.
I mean, there appears to have been a forthright class element in Parnell's political preferences. I mean, he really wanted his own landlord class at the political helm. He didn't think that his own party colleagues, most of them, were up to it, Frank.
Yes, I agree with what I think Margaret is saying, that Paul Bew goes slightly too far down that slightly reductionist line, Parnell's allegiance to his caste, which... I'm slightly sceptical about. I mean, certainly he is very alive to the need to preserve essentially a smaller residential gentry class. He sees that as central socially, central economically. But it's not what drives Parnell's imagination.
The idea, Margaret, that he was all things to all men, you know, that the small farmers thought he was on their side, so likewise the strong farmers.
Well, I was reading some of his speeches. I mean, for example, the speech in 1883 after he receives the testimonial. And it's quite interesting how assiduous and meticulous he is in addressing the needs of the different groupings that constitute his support. So he is all things to all men. But if you look at the attention he gives in, say, 1883 to the labourers, you know, to the plight of the rural labourers, of the urban poor, he does keep insisting that the, you know, the larger tenants are not alone to benefit. So, yeah, he is all things to all men. But I suppose the other strength of Bew's book is he presents him as a kind of tragic hero. And the tragic hero, I suppose, by definition, embodies within himself all kinds of ideas borne by others. So, yeah, he's all things to all men, but I don't think it's unwarranted. He is an extraordinarily complex and sophisticated political animal, and he does seem to have an understanding of the needs of a whole set of groups.
I mean, people would have said of him, they've said of so many outstanding politicians, Frank, that he was slippery. They wondered if he had any principles at all.
Yes, that was a famous remark that Joe Bigger made to Tim Healy shortly before Bigger died in 1890, shortly before the split broke. He said to Healy, "I wonder what Parnell's politics were." I mean, there is that aspect to, if you like, an enigma, not that keen on the word, but because I think a lot of the time it's pretty clear what Parnell wants to achieve. He's not an ideologue. He does have a vision of Irish nationalism. He is contemptuous of sort of faddists. He's contemptuous of people whose vision impairs their ability to achieve the vision. You know, he's in that but it's very high pragmatism. It's not crude. It's not.
How should we interpret that notion? You've already adverted to it, Charles, that he was motivated more by hatred of England than love of Ireland. How much weight should we attach to that?
Well, I think quite a lot, really. I think especially his early life and as his experience in England, and he certainly comes into politics taking a very anti-English stance in the 1870s, and that's how he wins the trust of the Fenians. They see in him someone who is prepared to stand up to the English and be anti-English. And I think there was a validity in what they perceived in that. There's always been a strange thing in the Republican psyche. They love people of Parnell's background who turn out to be Anglophobes. That's quite, and they trust them. I think they feel it's someone who's on equal terms with the English. And this gave him, he's unique among the parliamentary people in the way he was respected by those of the Sinn Féin tradition. When they wouldn't own O'Connell and they wouldn't own Redmond, they still, Parnell was great. De Valera sort of praised him up and said he was really a separatist. And pan-nationalists saw him as the person who could build a broad nationalist front. So he had this strange appeal.
Nonetheless, moderate home rulers, Margaret, Paul Bew points out, would have been on edge. They would have seen him as dangerous, Parnell, that is, to some degree.
I suppose it depends on what you mean by moderate home rulers. I mean, some of them are people he would barely have swung over from liberalism. Moderate home rulers. I don't think there's any great reason to feel on edge about him from the mid-80s to the time of the split. But as Frank Callanan shows in the Parnell split, they certainly had at the period of the split, which is kind of a different phase of politics.
I mean, how do you interpret that speech in Cincinnati in 1880 where he spoke of breaking the last link which keeps Ireland bound to England?
Well, Paul Bewe would like to say that it's just rhetoric for an American audience, but I've actually, one of the sources Paul mentions in the book is a whole collection of all of his speeches that are deposited in Queen's Library. And looking through them, I was amazed by the consistency of that kind of rhetoric over a very long period, which kind of takes us back to the question as to whether he was, you know, how much anti-Englishness drove him.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's fair to say that he's I mean, he's driven, I think, by a very particular sense of himself as an Irish patriot, a member of the Irish gentry. At one point he says to his brother, and Bew quotes this, be careful, don't talk to them. They'll never have met an Irish gentleman. They won't even know what one is. He's very, very conscious of his class, conscious of his status, but he sees himself as an Irish patriot, an Irish gentleman, and he thinks, possibly because he spent so much time in England, that he gets the English. He understands what they're like and he knows how to function and operate in their midst, which is, in his opinion, you know, a lot of his fellow countrymen don't. I mean, the class thing, I think, is huge for him.
Mm-hmm. You were saying earlier, Charles, that Paul Bewe has constructed a Parnell to some degree in his own image. I mean,
Yes. Related
to that is the notion that Paul Bewe stresses is that Parnell grasped the fact that sectarianism would become more and more of a problem. I mean, he says, in fact, he did little about it. But that's an example, isn't it, of the kind of thing you were talking about.
Yes, I think so, yes, and that he had some early insight into the whole Ulster difficulty, which I think he must be indicted with not foreseeing it at all, really, to get Ulster on side. And in a way, he allowed the Irish Party to antagonise people like the Liberals, Presbyterians in Ulster, from the nationalist cause. Whether it could have been avoided, I don't know, but he didn't do well in that direction.
He sees the legacy in terms of very much, I suppose, John Redmond. Frank, no doubt about that, is there?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in a sense, the Parnell legacy divides between the Irish Party and at least Griffith's Sinn Féin. Mm-hmm. Griffith has a very strong sense of Parnell to the point where he's suspected by Republicans of sort of backsliding because of his support of Parnell in the split when Griffith was a young man. I think where Parnell, Charles was talking about the view of Fenians towards Parnell. I think where Parnell probably scored over Redmond was that there was always a sense from those quotations that Margaret has referred to Parnell somehow seeing the historic limitations on home rule while supporting it. Mm. I think he could see the historic, he could convey an intimation that he was aware of the historic limitations on the idea in a way that Redmond was less successful in conveying.
Towards the end of the book, the point is made by Paul Bewe that once the masses got involved in politics, as they did in the period 1879 to 1882, the leaders were swept along. You know, he suggests that it was the action of the people that imposed a unity on the leadership, and yet the body of the book is a study in high politics. You know, the tenantry are merely bit players. They're seen really as existing at the whims of the actions of the big players.
Yeah, I suppose to be, you could say it's the complex interaction between the two, couldn't you? And I suppose, it's 1884, 1885, they're the years, or into 86, of the huge expansion of the franchise in Britain and in Ireland. And many of these issues are created. I mean, for example, one of the areas that Paul Bewe perhaps doesn't emphasise as much as he might is the scale and extent of Conservative opposition to the Home Rule project after 1886. And you could argue, if you look at people like Salisbury, the leader of the Conservative Party, they're casting around for a politics that will appeal to this new electorate they have to satisfy. And in many ways, you know, danger to the empire is very convenient for British Conservatives in that period. I suppose for Parnell, the mass politics thing permits the number of seats that permit him to retain or have at periods the balance of power. But I don't think...
But my point, though, is if the leaders were swept along, then the peasantry should have had a stronger profile.
Well, I suppose it's back to Frank's point in a way, isn't it? The job of the leader is, if you like, to articulate and construct a narrative and a way forward that is acceptable to those behind him. I mean, if you look at Parnell, for example, say at the time of the plan of campaign, obviously people like Dillon and Healy think that the plan of campaign, continuing the land issue as an active one on certain estates, is what will appeal to an electorate. But Parnell holds on to a kind of different politics, which wishes to regulate that to a side issue. I mean, I'm not quite answering your question, but the nature of the relationship, I think there's sufficient relation between Parnell and his electorate. He kind of gives them what they want. He stays quite closely to them. And another thing that Paul gets in this book is the extent to which his public image gratifies his electorate. But, I mean, I suppose what Paul Bew is writing here is a high political story of Parnell.
Let me develop,
by definition, a lot excluded.
Let me develop the point of the masses a bit more. I mean, he speaks of the tenants as belonging to an undifferentiated mass called the peasantry. Now, in his big book, Ireland, The Politics of Enmity, he does devote space to outlining in a more differentiated manner the kind of social structure that obtained in late 19th century Ireland. You know, at the top of that social structure were approximately 50,000 to 100,000 richer snug farmers. The mean size of whose holdings was 88 and 50 acres respectively. Together with the 10,000 or so landlords, they cultivate roughly the land and so control excess to much of the rest, and on it goes. You see my point about that?
I suppose Paul Bew's earlier work did emphasise a lot the differences within the rural tenantry and the ways in which certain categories of them benefited and others didn't. But yeah, he certainly emphasised that a lot less in this work.
Frank?
Yes, he does. What Parnell does do, he does try to sort of break down, because it is a sort of huge political monolith, if you like, the I suppose the Catholic farmer class of Ireland, the Catholic tenant class of Ireland is a huge monolith. And Parnell, he's always playing a bit with the idea of trying to use the smaller tenants to constrain the potential dominance.
I mean, he uses
a
kind of shorthand here, is my point, where it might benefit from being spelled out in a more differentiated way.
Yes, but it just is extraordinary what Parnell tries, but he never goes for a class politics. It's just a subtle a subtle play.
Sure. Charles Lysett, your view of it, the sense that it's a book of high politics, and yet at one level he's saying that the leaders are swept along by the masses.
Well, he said, yes, I think he dwelt on that in the 1880, the early period, and I think almost as if Parnell took fright in that and imposed a conservative cap on the thing. I think that would be his thesis.
The idea that in if you look back, and Paul Bew is building on the 1980 book, but what, Frank, have been the big shifts, and you've looked at this in some detail, in the understanding and evaluating of Parnell since he died? What have been the big shifts?
Well, there's been a lot written. Excellent material, beginning with Barry O'Brien's biography in 1898, who knew Parnell, and that's a both affectionate and brilliant portrait of Parnell that's quite significant for Yeats and Joyce, quite significant for the later Parnell myth. Catherine O'Shea produces her memoirs during the First World War. They obviously shift towards a more romantic conception of Parnell, which came as a great shock. That was a huge thing at the time, because nobody had really imagined Parnell being written of by a lover. That was that was sensational. His former colleagues were mortified, shocked. And then you get into the modern scholarly period. That begins with Conor Cruise O'Brien's Parnell and His Party in 1957, which is still astonishingly fresh. I mean, it's a major achievement. Lyons, Moody. I mean, this, in a sense, I think Paul Bew's book is the end of that classic consolidating phase of scholarship. I mean, there will continue to be books written about Parnell.
Roy Foster worked on The Family, didn't
he? He did. And that's a fine book.
And is he building? And by the way, the new data available to Paul Bew, how significant is that?
I'm not certain that it I don't think it shifts. I think what's more important is his interpretation.
The matter of new data, is there much there that he's got hold of, Margaret?
In terms of new material,
Yes.
He talks about letters from 76 to 79. That I didn't quite get what was new there. But what I suppose he does try to emphasise is there's a whole central section on the Special Commission into Parnellism and Crime. And within that, Paul Bew draws on the work of Patrick Mohm, which suggests that Parnell was sworn into the Fenians in the library of Trinity College shortly after coming out of Kilmainham. I suppose he's got quite a bit of new material around that, around the career of people like Sheridan and Egan, who had been Fenians and had been close to them. And under the surface of the middle section of the book, I suppose it sits a little uneasily with the suggestion that Parnell is this conservative ally to the landlords, but there's this vague suggestion that perhaps his contacts with the Phoenix Park murderers were not what the Special Commission suggested, were perhaps a little closer than historians have represented them as being. But Paul Bew slightly pulls his punches on that. But there's enough material. There is some new material in there in relation to that.
We've been discussing Enigma, A New Life of Charles Stewart Parnell by Paul Bew, published by Gill and Macmillan. My thanks to Margaret O'Callaghan, Charles Lycett and Frank Callanan. You can listen to the programme again on our Off the Shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.